From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, family values and the religious war for the soul of America. We talk with Patrick Buchanan's policy director, Terry Jeffrey, about the family as defined by the conservative right. Also, political consultant and advisor to the Clinton campaign, Samuel Popkin, gives us his take on how Republicans are manipulating the issue of family values. He's the author of The Reasoning Voter, a book about how voters choose candidates. And commentator Maureen Corrigan tells us about the horror story that still scares her. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Republican National Convention closes tonight after acceptance speeches from President George Bush and Vice President Dan Quayle. The delegates and the pundits alike are expecting a rousing speech from the president as a send-off for the fall campaign. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
It's a cliche by now to say this is a make-or-break speech for the president, and privately some of his aides are now saying as long as Mr. Bush does reasonably well tonight, he should get enough of a bounce out of this convention to put him on the road to campaign recovery. Already some tracking polls are showing Mr. Bush narrowing the gap with Governor Bill Clinton, his Democratic opponent. One poll even has the differential down to 5 points. The president is widely expected this evening to talk about future tax cuts in general terms, but not to advance any specific proposals. In his appearances so far in Houston, he's demonstrated a new energy and enthusiasm for the campaign, a fire that, if the president keeps breathing tonight, should ignite the delegates and douse the depression that has often been apparent on the convention floor this week. I'm Nina Totenberg in Houston.
Three major U.S. health organizations have attacked a panel headed by Vice President Quayle, a council on competitiveness. The groups are the American Heart Association, the American Cancer Society, and the American Lung Association. They charge that the council has used its power to get around open governmental processes on behalf of special interest groups. The council reviews regulations on air pollution, food labeling, and other issues, ordering changes if it finds the regulations would unnecessarily burden individuals and small businesses. The health groups say the council is helping a few special interests defeat health and safety rules. The groups expressed concern that the council would undermine attempts to improve nutritional labeling, enforce the Clean Air Act, and curtail the use of tobacco. Democratic presidential candidate Bill Clinton has gained the endorsement of the National Association of Police Organizations, which represents more than 135,000 officers across the country. The endorsement came as Clinton arrived in Detroit for a 2-day campaign stop. Phil Denieri of member station WDET reports.
The president of the Police Officers Organization says the law enforcement community believed in President Bush 4 years ago, but has become disillusioned with the president's performance. Clinton turned his attention to the emphasis Republicans have been putting on family values. He says it is hypocritical for the Republicans to speak about family values on the one hand, but criticize his wife Hillary on the other.
My wife has gotten up every day for 20 years and worked on helping children and families. She has one of the most distinguished records of any private citizen in America in helping families and children.
Clinton leaves for Cleveland tomorrow afternoon to begin his third campaign bus tour. For National Public Radio, I'm Phil Denieri in Detroit.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 2 points today to finish at 3,304. This is NPR. A top United Nations representative left Libya today with no sign that he's persuaded the government of Muammar Gaddafi to hand over two men suspected in the 1988 bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. Vladimir Petrovsky left Tripoli after spending 5 days in Libya, meeting with the foreign minister about measures that Libya should take to end a 4-month UN embargo on air traffic and weapons. The French government said today that it would provide 10 aircraft to enforce an air exclusion zone in Iraq. News reports say Washington is wavering on the idea of using military intervention to protect the Shiites in southern Iraq. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Defense Minister Pierre Joxe said that France, like Britain, is preparing to establish a no-fly zone in southern Iraq. British Prime Minister John Major said that France, Britain, and the United States would tell the Iraqi government not to fly any planes in southern Iraq. He said any Iraqi planes that did fly there would be shot down. He also said that if the Iraqis fought back, they would lose. Britain has promised to provide 6 Tornado combat aircraft and 2 refueling aircraft to police the zone. The French defense minister said France would make a similar contribution by sending 10 planes. He said they would probably be Mirage 2000 fighter jets. It's expected that the planes will fly to Iraq from a base in southern France. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
United Nations officials said today that a UN cargo plane successfully delivered food and medicine to the besieged city of Juba in southern Sudan. The Russian-built cargo plane with UN markings brought 24 tons of grain and 16 tons of medical supplies to the town, which ran out of food 10 days ago. Conditions in Juba were reported to be very bad, with some 300,000 people facing starvation. The UN operation was carried out in defiance of Sudanese rebels, who said the area is a war zone and refused to grant permission for any plane to land. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Last night was Family Values Night at the Republican Convention in Houston. In her speech, Barbara Bush talked about how happy she was when she carpooled and was a den mother, and of how the Bush family went to church, cheered at the 4th of July fireworks, and sang carols together at Christmas. The Republican Party platform blames the Democrats and government intrusion for undermining the stability of this kind of traditional American family. The Republican message this year is that theirs is the party of family values. But these values that the Republican Party stands for took on a more extreme tone on Monday night when Patrick Buchanan addressed the convention saying, "There's a religious war going on in our country for the soul of America. It's a cultural war. And in that struggle for the soul of America, Clinton and Clinton are on one side and George Bush is on our side." We invited Patrick Buchanan's policy director, Terry Jeffrey, on today to tell us more about this cultural war. I asked him what everyone is asking everyone else this week, how he defines traditional family values.
Well, I think family values are the values that you see going back pretty much all the way to Adam and Eve. Humanity has isolated and defined these things right from the beginning, but I think, first of all, family is mom and dad and children. I think there are a lot of specious definitions of a family going around out there, and probably the most outrageous one is that two men or two women living together constitute a family. I think everybody really, a family is, you recognize it when you see one, but since all Americans grew up in families, I think they know what they are.
Well, what you seem to be saying is very different from what Barbara Bush said last night at the Republican Party convention. She said, however you define family, that's how we define family values. She said family means putting your arms around each other and being there.
Well, that is something that people and families would do. But I think if you're talking about a definition of what is and is not a family, I think that's really what is at the root of it, is that if you take something and you redefine it and you redefine it, eventually you can end up making it mean nothing. And that's what some groups in our society are now doing to the word family. A family quite strictly means a mother and a father and children. And you can use it in a general sense to describe a baseball team. You know, I think the Pittsburgh Pirates used to call them a family, but clearly that's just metaphorical and figurative. But when you try and take the literal sense of a family and say that, say, two homosexuals living together are the same thing as a mom and a dad and a child, you completely debase and destroy the word and make it meaningless. And then if you apply family values, use family as an adjective and say family values and describe something that can pertain to two homosexuals living together and also to a mom and dad and a child, you've completely destroyed the concept of family values.
Well, let me just ask you something. Let's take a gay couple that has a child.
Right.
They don't commit adultery. They teach this child about caring for others. They go to church. They pay their school taxes. They set a good example. What's wrong with that picture of a family?
Well, by definition, a homosexual couple is promiscuous. Because by definition, a homosexual couple is engaging in sexual activity out of wedlock. And it's not only sexual activity. I mean, it's on one level, it's akin to extramarital or premarital sex. But then there's another level because it's unnatural and perverse sex. So I think that, I mean, what you're trying to do is create some sort of equation there between a heterosexual couple who have had their union endorsed by God and the state in traditional marriage, that when they engage in sexual activity may lead to procreation, which is children, in the creation of a family, and another unit, which is a woman and a woman or a man and a man, that is not sanctioned by God, it's not sanctioned by the state, and there's no way that their union can ever lead to the creation of children. So, I mean, there's absolutely no equation right from the beginning, right down at the core of a homosexual relationship, there's a lie.
But if you're talking about the kinds of values being transmitted adult to child, and we'll say parent to child within a family,
right.
You're talking about how society views this particular family, but how about how this family views itself and how it views the children within the family? And if they are doing if they are trying to transmit the kinds of values that you believe in, but they don't have the kind of relationship that you
right.
believe in, what's wrong with that?
Well, I think you'll find homosexual unions transmitting the AIDS virus more often than they're transmitting family values. But sure, hypothetically, you can have a situation where someone is engaged in something that is extremely disordered, like a homosexual relationship. It's immoral, it's completely out of order with nature, and having made this giant leap into what is a perverse lifestyle, stops with perversity there and does everything else according to the normal traditional Judeo-Christian moral code. That's hypothetically possible. I think, however, if you honestly look at what's happened in our society since there's been a great upsurge in the incidence of homosexuality, that you find a lot of other things going by the boards, too. In fact, I think if you look, you can look at the social and cultural history of our country, starting almost from the 1950s, and see a general slide in public morality. And attendant with that slide in public morality, you see things falling apart. And I think it's very clear, actually, to someone who sits back and looks at it rationally. When you have a massive increase in the incidence of divorce, when you're aborting 1.5 million babies every year, when you have 150,000 Americans dead already of a venereally transmitted virus, these things, in the 1950s, you didn't have X number of people dying from a venereal transmitted virus every year. The change in our moral conduct as a people is reflected in our health as a community.
How do you suggest that President Bush address the threat that you perceive that homosexuals pose to family values?
Well, first of all, I think maybe we've focused a little bit too much on homosexuals. So I think the prevalence of homosexual activity in America is symbolic of a general movement away from traditional morality. But I think that, number one, that the presidency is the bully pulpit, and that the president has an obligation to speak up for the truth. And the truth in this area, in terms of morality and traditional morality and sticking up for it, it's very hard to do because the popular culture is against it completely, and you become an enemy. I think Dan Quayle, for example, was demonized when he took on Murphy Brown. But what Dan Quayle said about Murphy Brown was absolutely completely correct. I give him great credit for the courage he's had in sticking by it and keeping up the fight. And Bill Bennett gave a pretty good speech on the same theme last night. So I think, number one, national leaders, articulate, intelligent people have to go out there and stick up for the truth and not flinch and not walk away from it and not be intimidated by the media and a general adversary culture that is going to come down on them with everything they have, because they rightly perceive that people who stand up for traditional values, who stand up for the morality that has been with us from the beginning, are in fact the enemy of the established cultural elite in this country, which essentially has a pagan value system.
Well, let me just ask, and I don't want to get sidetracked on Murphy Brown, but she, and as we all know, is a fictitious character, but she was given a choice between having a baby and having an abortion.
Right.
She chose the baby. Isn't that pro-family?
And the show made clear that it was a legitimate choice to kill the baby. It is not a legitimate choice to kill the baby. Anybody who thinks it's a legitimate choice to kill an unborn baby is a moral idiot. And that show presented the decision of moral idiocy as the equivalent of a decision of moral righteousness, which is to protect the innocent.
The platform, the Republican Party platform on abortion, is rather more conservative than President Bush's stated position on abortion. The platform wants to outlaw all abortions, and the president has stated several times that he wants to outlaw abortion except in cases of rape, incest, and the life of the mother.
Right.
How do you square those two positions? And let's also say that, that Barbara Bush said that abortion shouldn't be on the platform at all.
Well, Barbara Bush was wrong to make that comment, and quite frankly, your opinion is incorrect. And there's definitely a problem with tracking that logically, because what it really boils down to is you either have human life or you don't. And if an unborn child is a lump of protoplasm no different from a tumor, then there's really nothing morally wrong with excising that lump of tissue. But if an unborn child is in fact an unborn child, which all medical science indicates that it is, or she or he is, then there's really nothing you can do and no way you can rationalize saying it's okay for someone else to go in and exterminate that life. So I think you do have a problem with people in political life tend to get away from the fundamental things, and they tend to lose track of what really is at issue here. And I think
so you don't agree with the president then
on that it's okay to abort a child who was born who was conceived in incest?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely not. It's completely inconsistent position philosophically, morally, and otherwise. I think he could clarify his thinking on that. There's no question about it.
My guest on Fresh Air today is Terry Jeffrey. He's the policy director for Patrick Buchanan. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Terry Jeffrey. He's the policy director for Patrick Buchanan. Tell us what this cultural and religious war is about that Patrick Buchanan spoke about when he was addressing the Republican National Convention.
Okay, I think what you have is the traditional values of the American people, which derive from the Judaic Christian tradition, and you have people who very much want to live their lives according to that tradition, and they want to pass that tradition on to their children. They want to do it through the nurturing in the home, and they want to do it through what goes on in the schools, and they want to do it through our popular culture. And on the other side, you have a school system and a popular culture, and even some elements in our government that want to take, essentially, our children away from us and create them as a new man or a new woman whose value system is completely removed and alien from Judeo-Christian culture. And
how do they want to take children away from families?
Well, I tell you what. I mean, I think if you look at the sex education programs in the schools, you see where it's really happening. Let's say that you're a Catholic like I am, and you want to raise your child to believe in sexuality and the way someone ought to deal with their sexuality the way the Catholic Church believes in it. You send your child to a public school, the sex education program in the public school has completely a different agenda. They have sort of a pragmatic morality of sex. They talk about things like safe sex and so forth. So at that point, you set up a conflict of interest between the parent and the school over who that child's going to become. Now, when you look at the popular culture and the school system and even some things that the government is doing, you see that across the board. For example, I mean, what the Democratic Party is trying to do by completely legitimizing homosexual unions and putting them on a legal level, that's implying that they're on a moral level with heterosexual chaste marriage. They're trying to say, I mean, as you know, if Bill Clinton's going to be elected president and get up in that bully pulpit and tell every child in America that it's equally okay to grow up and be a homosexual, engage in homosexual activity, as to grow up and be married and love your wife and be faithful to her and have children, then you have real cultural war going on there. I mean, that is a very radical thing. I would ask you to imagine in your mind what would happen if George Washington or Thomas Jefferson were to be allowed to come to Bill Clinton's inaugural, were he elected, and hear him declare that he was four square in favor of homosexual rights. It's inconceivable that in 200 years a Republican has gotten to the point where someone could have a view that is so radical and so alien from what made America great and what we stand for. That is truly radical.
Patrick Buchanan talked about Judeo-Christian values and
right,
wanting to support those kinds of values.
Right.
First of all, what are those values as you see them? And by just talking about Judeo-Christian values, are certain people being left out?
No, absolutely not. I think, first of all, the most clear statement of Judeo-Christian values are in the Ten Commandments, in the law that God handed down to the Jews, in which Christians embrace, as Christianity is a religion that was derived from a Jewish tradition. And actually, if you look at, C.S. Lewis wrote a great book where he sort of went around and looked at all the religions of the world and the common morality. But there is a phenomenon called natural law. Clarence Thomas tried to talk a little bit about it in his nomination hearings, and I think Thomas Aquinas is probably the clearest enunciator of it. And I recall that Martin Luther King referred to Thomas Aquinas when he wrote his letter from the Birmingham jail, and he said, "A just law is a law that comports with nature as God created nature, and a just law, an unjust law is one that does not." And I think that literally all human beings, because they are creatures of God, have at least a germ of an understanding of natural law, which goes along with the natural order. And I think, for example, when you talk about abortion and homosexuality and those sorts of things, they are clear violations of the natural law. It's not natural for a mother to kill her child. It's not natural for men and men to engage in sexual activity. And I think if you look at all the religions and all the cultures of the world, you see that there is a common gravity back towards the natural law, so that the morality that Jews and Christians embrace, and the morality that Muslims embrace, and the morality that Buddhists embrace, and even the morality that right-thinking atheists embrace, is the same thing, pretty much. We all agree that murder is wrong.
But why use the word Judeo-Christian values when you're really talking about something larger than that?
Well, no, because America is a country. We're not a Buddhist country. The United States is not in Far East Asia. The United States is a country that's roots and traditions come out of Europe. And Europe is a country whose philosophical and religious roots go back into Greece, and they go back into the Middle East, specifically to Palestine and the homeland of the Jewish people and the homeland of Christianity where it came out of. I mean, there's no question that that is the linear line of our tradition. And I'd say more than that, that, you know, if you are a believing Christian or if you are a believing Jew, you believe in your religion and you know it's true. And, you know, we're proud of that.
Is feminism a threat to family values?
Absolutely.
In what way?
Well, if you're talking about the feminism of Hillary Clinton, which says that minor children ought to be allowed to sue their parents, I think what you have there is very clear. You have someone saying that the state ought to come in and be sovereign in the family rather than the mother and the father. That somehow the state is more qualified morally and otherwise to arbitrate in a family. And
well, I believe the case that she was referring to is a case in Florida of a young boy who was taken away from his mother because she abused him. He was put into a foster family, wants to stay with that particular foster family, and is actually suing his mother to release him from her so that he can stay with the family that has loved him.
Let me read you exactly what Hillary Clinton said, because I have the quote right here. This is from an article she published in 1979 called Children's Rights, a Legal Perspective. It says, quote, I prefer that intervention into an ongoing family be limited to decisions that could have long-term and possibly irreparable effects if they are not resolved. Decisions about motherhood and abortion, schooling, cosmetic surgery, treatment of venereal disease or employment, and others where the decision or lack of one will significantly affect the child's future should not be made unilaterally by parents. Children should have the right to be permitted to decide their own future if they are competent. When she's talking about intervention, she's talking about intervention by the courts. She's talking about minor children being able to go to the courts to, quote-unquote, make decisions about motherhood, abortion, schooling, cosmetic surgery, treatment of venereal disease, or employment. Your 13-year-old kid, in the most absurd case, wants to get a new nose. You say no, Hillary says she can take you to court, or an abortion.
I believe the cosmetic surgery case that she was referring to was a teenage girl who was born with a pretty serious facial disfigurement. She wanted to have plastic surgery, and her parents did not, saying that's basically the face that you were born with.
Schooling. Your 13-year-old son wants to go to the public school. You want to send him to the Christian school. He takes you to court. I mean, there's no question what she's saying here. She's saying that minor children should be able to bring the court into the family to settle disputes about motherhood, abortion, schooling, cosmetic surgery, treatment of venereal disease, or employment. Now, what does she mean by treatment of venereal disease? You want your child to be treated, and the child doesn't want to be treated, so she can take you to court and sue you not to get treated? I mean, it's there's no question what she's saying here. It's a radical thing. It's a radical idea to say that a minor child should be able to sue a parent over a decision what high school they're going to go to.
At what point do you think the state should have an interest in what's going on inside a family life? And
I'll tell you one thing that's absolutely for certain. that the state has an obligation to stop a mother from aborting her child.
And beyond that?
Now, that's a place where Hillary doesn't want to give the child a choice.
But beyond that, where do you and Patrick Buchanan see the state's interest in a family?
Well, I think if you look at the 14th Amendment, you have rights spelled out that that cannot be violated, and clearly that a parent cannot violate the child's rights of right to life, right to security in his person. And I think that we have criminal statutes that take care of these kind of things. I mean, it is against the law to abuse your child. It is against the law to kill your child unless your child is unborn.
The polls really tell us that what people are most interested in is our jobs and the state of the economy.
Mm-hmm.
What does family values have to do with that?
Well, jobs, why does someone want a job? I mean, the fundamental thing is you need resources to live. You need money to put food on the table. You need money to buy clothes for your children. I know from my personal experience that people. I'm 34 years old. I have two children. I don't own a home because homes are too expensive in the Washington area for someone who does the sorts of things I do. And I know a great many people who are in my situation who are wondering: are we ever going to be able to replicate sort of comfortable middle class family life that our parents had? And, you know, there's some folks who go into law or banking who are smart guys or women make that kind of money. And, you know, you're talking about a lot of money in most of the metropolitan areas of this country in order to replicate the traditional American middle-class way of life that people enjoyed in the 50s and 60s in this country. And I think that it's interconnected, really. And especially, and I'll tell you what intensifies it. When you want to raise your child to believe in the traditional things that Americans have believed in. You want to bring them fully into the Judeo-Christian Western tradition that is fundamentally what the United States is all about. And you have an adversary culture, which through its TV and its public school and its popular culture wants to take your child and make your child something else. What money becomes is a tool for protecting your child from that adversary culture, for providing tuition for a school that's not going to corrupt what your child believes in, for providing a home where they're safe from the crime that goes on in the streets, finding that home in a neighborhood where there aren't drug dealers on the corner. That's why people want to work and make money, to provide for their families. So really, employment is a very, very key issue, and it's an important one. Republicans have to do things to turn the economy around. There's no question about it.
Let me ask you, by attacking radical feminism and the ideas of Hillary Clinton and the lifestyles of homosexuals, who are you trying to woo?
What you're trying to do is stand up for what America believes in. What this country needs is good moral leadership, and I think Beth Buchanan is a great leader. And I think I'll tell you why was there this Perot phenomenon earlier this year? I think a lot of it was that there's a great many people in this country, most of whom I think are middle class, who they're not just alienated from our government; they're disgusted with our government. And I think what really caused that disgust, that alienation, is they look at Washington, they listen to politicians, and they hear them saying nothing. They hear them lie, they see them cheat, and they won't take a stand for anything. You ask them a direct question, like, what do you think about a homosexual rights bill? Most the average Washington politician would duck that question because it's too hot to handle. And I think that there's a large group of people in our society, they see politicians act like that, they've been seeing it going on, and they're just sick and tired of it.
But who are you trying to appeal to?
Regular Americans who believe in the things that made America great.
Terry Jeffrey is the policy director for Patrick Buchanan. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen with Fresh Air. Coming up, the Democratic perspective on family values. We talk with Clinton campaign advisor Samuel Popkin. He says the Republicans are making a big mistake by attacking Hillary Clinton and Murphy Brown. Popkin is the author of The Reasoning Voter, about how voters choose candidates. And commentator Maureen Corrigan tells us about the horror story that haunts her still after 20 years. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A new survey indicates that President Bush is getting a bounce from the Republican National Convention, much in the same way that challenger Bill Clinton did from the Democratic Convention in New York last month. CBS News is reporting that the GOP ticket now has narrowed Clinton's lead to 11 points, with 51% for the Democrats and 40% for the Republicans. The president's approval rating was almost unchanged at 39%, but Clinton's favorable rating was down 5 points to 31%. Mr. Bush has been working today on his acceptance speech that he will give tonight, and Robert Teeter says the president's comments will be a preview of the fall campaign.
He'll talk about the general themes that he wants to continue to articulate over the next several weeks. He'll talk about some of the policy directions that he wants to go in over the next 4 years that he'll be talking about in more detail over the next 2, 3, 4 weeks. And then he'll begin to sharpen some of the contrast with his opponents.
Teeter is chairman of the Bush-Quayle campaign. Democratic presidential contender Bill Clinton has been campaigning today in Michigan in efforts to gain back Democrats who voted for President Bush 4 years ago. Clinton, speaking at noon in Battle Creek, charged that Bush economic policies only help lawyers, lobbyists, and special interest groups in Washington. Clinton told a midday rally it's been tried their way, now it's time for a change. He received an endorsement from a group of former supporters of Ross Perot. A federal grand jury has started deliberations in the Iran-Contra trial of former CIA officer Claire George. He's charged with lying to congressional investigators and a grand jury about the Reagan administration's arms for hostages deal that channeled profits to the Contras. NPR's Anthony Brooks reports.
During the 1980s, Claire George was the number three man at the CIA in charge of covert actions around the world. He's the most senior intelligence official to be charged, accused of obstructing justice and lying to two congressional committees as well as a grand jury. Today, Judge Royce Lamberth instructed the jury not to consider their own views about the wisdom of that secret policy, but to focus solely on the facts of the case as they've emerged over the past 5 weeks. In closing arguments yesterday, the defense portrayed George as a distinguished career public servant who's been unfairly targeted for political reasons. The prosecution charged that George offered lies and half-truths to conceal what he called a dirty little secret, then refused to accept responsibility for his actions. The judge ordered that the jury be sequestered throughout their deliberations, which could last through the weekend. In Washington, this is Anthony Brooks.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 2 points to close at 3,304.89 on volume of more than 183 million shares. Trading today was active. This is NPR News. Iraqi President Saddam Hussein says a Western plan to create what's called a safe haven for Shiite Muslims in the southern part of the country is a conspiracy to divide Iraq. His comments were carried by the official Iraqi news agency and turn aside any effort to limit flights for Iraqi warplanes. Under the plan now being considered by Persian Gulf War allies, Iraqi planes would be banned from a certain area, and if they crossed the line, they would be attacked. UN officials say that thousands and thousands of residents of Somalia face death by starvation unless the international community mounts a massive rescue effort. Sophie Fisher filed this report for the BBC.
According to the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, time is now of the essence in Somalia. Ian McLeod, a field worker, warned that the next 3 to 6 months were crucial. Food alone won't save the people. Medical help is now needed, too, 2 million people were on the borders of death. 3.5 million more have no basic services. Aid workers are welcoming the prospect of UN troops arriving to protect aid convoys. But Ian McClone warned that the security problems shouldn't be used as an excuse not to help.
It's easier to get food and medicines to save lives in Somalia than it is to find peace in ex-Yugoslavia.
An appeal for $22 million has so far brought in only $300,000. If more money doesn't arrive soon, the agency will consider scaling down its work, a prospect they describe as devastating.
Sophie Fisher in Geneva. In Washington, the government said today that the number of first-time claims for unemployment benefits climbed by 71,000 in the latest reporting week. It was the largest jump in more than 10 years. The Labor Department says that new unemployment claims came to 474,000 in the week ending August 8th. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Samuel Popkin is a veteran of many presidential campaigns. He assisted George McGovern and Jimmy Carter in their bid for office and is currently a pollster and advisor to the Clinton campaign. Popkin is a professor of political science at the University of California in San Diego. He's also the author of The Reasoning Voter, in which he argues that campaigns are not useless fluff and voters are not the victims of media manipulation. According to Popkin, they can wade through the ads, the rhetoric, and the accusations to make a thoughtful and reasoned decision. We asked him to join us on Fresh Air today to comment on the Republican Party convention and talk about the issue of traditional family values. We began with his definition of a family.
In America, the family values that people really care about are long-term nurturing. Where do you, to paraphrase Robert Frost, the place where they have to take care of you when you show up at the doorstep. And it's the group of blood relatives, marriage relatives, friends, and acquaintances that are part of your support network.
What do you think is the appeal of family values in this 92 campaign?
The appeal in 92 is to try and paint the Democrats as Southern fried McGovern, to try and suggest that the generation of the 60s are still as out of touch with America as was painted in the 72 campaign. The people running the Republican campaign are people who cut their teeth in 72 and 76, when it was very easy for Republicans 20 years ago to say the Democrats represent, you know, breathless, zealous groups that don't know how to compromise and moderate their claims. And they're trying it again to get attention away from the economy.
You watched the convention last night, I'm sure, and certainly the topic was family values. What message did you read from the speeches that you heard?
The message I heard was, we are better than our platform. Read us, read our families, not our platform. I heard very clearly two wives trying to very much distance themselves from the platform and talk about their life separate from the platform. And I think that happened because as the Republican Party has painted itself into a corner on a few of the social issues, you've gotten into the extraordinary situation this year where neither the president or the vice president could apply their own platform to the lives of their children. And this created this great disjuncture where I think they tried to have the wives speak, both because it's important and the wives are articulate, but also because they want to put distance between themselves and a platform that they can't defend.
You're a pollster. I'm wondering whether you've even polled the public about how they think about family values and how they care about them.
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot of polling on the subject because this is a real problem. You've got the two revolutions in America going on at once that we're all facing at the same time in middle age. One is the revolution that started in the 50s of women much more frequently working outside the home. This leads to a lot of crises of daycare, school hours, and managing home and family for both parents with children. At the same time, the benefits of Social Security, Medicare, and life expectancy mean that as we're doing daycare, we also have to worry about parent care and elderly care. So people are really concerned about whose job it is.
How does that translate into family values?
The reason the phrase family values is being used is very bluntly because a key core constituent element of the Republican dominance of the White House in the last 30 years has been the attachment to the economic conservatives of religious fundamentals who are alienated from the Democratic Party. And family values to them means an explicit, specific reading of the Bible. So you've got family values meaning two things today in America. For 11% of us or 10% of us, it means an extreme, exact, doctrinaire reading of what a family should be, a woman should be, and a parent should be. For the rest of us, it means coming to grips with the fact that we can't even pretend we've got an Ozzie and Harriet world anymore. We've got more of the kind of world Delia Ephron talks about in her books, where you have to decide at a wedding whether the grandchildren of your mother-in-law's deceased second husband should also be invited to the wedding.
If this is a small group, as you say, a core group of the Republican Party, how have they made this such an important issue and one that's being talked about even as we talk about it?
Well, I think there are two things. Number one, early this year, it appeared that we were going to have a three-way race for the presidency. And in a three-way race for the presidency, the fundamentalists represented a very strong third or more of what the Republicans needed to win the presidency. And so mugging Murphy Brown, you know, an all-out attack on Murphy Brown in a three-way race when you had a moderate pro-choice candidate in Ross Perot and another moderate pro-choice candidate in Bill Clinton, being conservative and fundamentalist, had real appeal. The problem was that at the same time the Republicans were mugging Murphy Brown, they were also using a character assassination on Ross Perot and turning this into a two-way race. And I'm willing to go online as a scholar as well as a part of the campaign and say that when history writes the history of this campaign, mugging Murphy Brown and mugging Hillary Clinton will be the two single biggest Republican mistakes of this year.
But do you think there is some resonance with the public, that people are feeling that there is something wrong with their life? They are concerned about what they see on television and in the movies. They're concerned about the numbers of pregnancy, the number of single mothers going on, and that people are beginning to ask themselves questions about their own values.
Yes.
and the nation's values.
Yes, I think that's very good. After this campaign is over and we go into a more reflective mode, there are going to be some very hard and difficult questions asked about one-parent, two-parent, three-parent, and four-parent families in America. What policy should be about either discouraging the mating patterns or encouraging better care of the children and putting it together.
Samuel Popkin is my guest. He's a professor of political science at the University of California at San Diego. He's also an advisor and a pollster to the Clinton campaign and the author of a book called The Reasoning Voter. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Samuel Popkin, and he's an advisor and a pollster to the Clinton campaign. How much do you think this whole discussion of family values is an exercise in nostalgia?
Well, I think all programs of social change reach back, whether it's the Chinese Revolution, the Reagan Revolution, or the Democratic Party. You reassure people by talking about the past as you make the changes necessary so that people can feel that they're not somehow cutting their emotional and umbilical cord to the past. And I think you see that in the very strong attempts now to have Barbara Bush play the role of Florence Nightingale and suggest that first ladies should really be grandmothers, not women of a new generation who have careers as well as family roles.
How much do you think Hillary Clinton is fair game? She's an attorney with a past. She's made speeches. She's written papers. How much do you think her writing, her thinking, should be involved in the campaign, should be an issue in the campaign?
Well, when you say fair game, let me make it clear. I'm distinguishing the fair facts of her record from what, of course, are unfair attacks by Rich Bond and Dan, the attack puppy, Dan Quayle.
What do you see as unfair attacks?
Trying to paint Hillary Clinton as an enemy of the family, as a person who wants our children to sue us for malpractice if we don't let them go to the Gap on Saturday, as a person who's anti-family. And
she has written, and this is not going to be a very good paraphrase, to that effect, saying that the children do have rights under certain circumstances in which they could sue their parents.
Well, we've got this terrible problem in our legal culture. Now, when you talk about a child suing the parent, you can paint this as a horror story of your daughter suing you if you don't let her stay up late to watch Murphy Brown on television. But what this is intended for is the horrible, and this speaks to your earlier point of the disjuncture between how we live and how we dream. The real reason you need some rights for children is that there are children living in homes full of drugs, sexual abuse, physical abuse, and alcoholism. And without some presumptive rights for those children, it's going to be impossible to rescue them from these unlivable situations.
So how much would you say of what Hillary Clinton has talked about and written about is fair to criticize and analyze in this campaign?
Well, the reason I said that mugging Hillary is going to turn out to be as big a mistake as mugging Murphy Brown is twofold. Number one, the Republicans also want to paint the Democrats as anti-business and out of touch with the world of either big corporations or family firms. And Hillary is a board member, is on the board of directors of Country's Best Yogurt and of Walmart. And it's hard to paint, you know, an American folk hero like Sam Walton as somebody who puts young lefties on their board. And secondly, one of the biggest successes Hillary has had in Arkansas was to encourage people in Arkansas to adopt a program that comes, of all places, from Israel called the Home Instruction Program for Preschool Youth. This program is praised as an exemplar of what can be done to help young children in America by Barbara Bush and her first book, a book called First Teachers, which is a family literacy handbook. And here in this book, Hillary is praised. And I think it says something about the problems the Republican Party is having this year, that to satisfy the religious right, you have to attack Hillary as they position themselves for 1996 at the price of embarrassing Mrs. Bush and putting her in the position where she's supposed to go along with these unfair and vicious attacks on somebody she's publicly praised in print.
What issues do you think this race will be decided on?
I think more than anything else, the two big issues are the immediate short-term economic crises that a lot of people are feeling in the big industrial states in California, and maybe even more important, the long-term need to deal with the change from a world oriented to Europe and the Cold War to a world oriented more to Asia, more to economics, and more to global markets. That's the painful one.
You've written a book called The Reasoning Voter. The assumption in your title, obviously, is that voters can make reasonable decisions, can make reasonable choices. Do you believe that?
Yes, I do. I think, for one thing, people learn over time. I think, for another, they learn how to assess character. They learn how to tell from who your friends are and where you've been and what you've done, how they think about you for the future. I actually think sometimes that choosing a president isn't just a matter of looking at the policies and the principles, but it's almost a little bit like picking a babysitter to stay with your children when you're away. It's not just the positions the babysitter espouses when she says, yes, I believe in vegetables and I don't believe in sugar, but it's also a matter of, will this babysitter know how to dial 911 if there's an emergency? Will this babysitter never go out and leave the kids alone? Will this person know enough to handle anything that's going to come up that I don't know about? So it's it's really a complicated job of giving a proxy to a person. And that process brings out both all the romanticism and idealism in us and also all of our cynicism.
Samuel Popkin is a pollster and advisor to the Clinton campaign. He teaches at the University of California at San Diego and is the author of The Reasoning Voter. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Lynn Neary has joined us to tell us about today's show. Hi, Lynn. What are you covering today?
Hi, Marty. Well, we'll be talking with a doctor who is working with victims of starvation in Somalia. We'll be talking about some of the severe medical problems that they're dealing with there. From Houston, Linda Wertheimer will have a piece reviewing the career of George Bush. We will visit the new cheetah exhibit at the National Zoo here in Washington. It's very interesting because they're using a device that gets the cheetahs running, and they do run at very high speeds at times. And NOAA will have a piece on some of Elvis Presley's earliest recordings with Sam Phillips at the Sun Studio in Memphis, Tennessee.
Thanks, Lynn. Those stories and more coming up later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Most horror stories take place on a dark and stormy night, in the dead of winter or during the melancholy season of fall. But there's one turn-of-the-century horror story that describes the evil peculiar to a summer's day, when the heat is so intense it can scramble your brain. Critic Maureen Corrigan offers a timely appreciation of William Fryer Harvey's horrific short story, August Heat.
I first stumbled upon W.F. Harvey's short story, August Heat, nearly 20 years ago in a collection of supernatural tales. Harvey is an overlooked master of the psychological horror story. You may know his most famous tale, The Beast with Five Fingers, which was made into a silly movie starring Peter Lorre. To understand why August Heat has haunted me for so long, you need to know a strange fact about my childhood. My father, for most of his working life, was a heating and refrigeration mechanic. He could take apart air conditioners and put them back together again blindfolded. But oddly enough, ours was the only apartment in the building without an air conditioner. Every summer, my mother and I would plead for one. My dad could get air conditioners wholesale, for heaven's sake. And always he would refuse. His reason? Air conditioners reminded him of work. To this day, he and my mother roast in that very same apartment. And when I visit in the summer, Harvey's story haunts my troubled sleep and my waking dreams. the power of August Heat comes mostly from its curious style. It's written as a diary entry by an artist named James Clarence Withencroft on the evening of August 20th, 1900. Withencroft has had the most remarkable day in his life. The morning dawned hot as hell, and Withencroft planned to spend the day at the local swimming hole. But suddenly, inspiration strikes, and he sketches for hours as if possessed. By afternoon, Withencroft has finished a bizarre picture of an enormously fat man, a murderer, standing in the dock just after a judge has pronounced sentence. Withencroft goes for a walk to clear his head. He walks for miles until he reaches a stonemason's cottage. In the yard, a man is cutting an inscription on a tombstone. He's a huge man with sweat pouring from his scalp. He's the man in Withencroft's sketch. Withencroft looks at the tombstone. It reads, "Sacred to the memory of James Clarence Withencroft. Born January 18th, 1860, he passed away very suddenly on August 20th, 190 blank. The stonemason, a Mr. Atkinson, claims the inscription was a sudden inspiration. Withencroft shows him his sketch. They ponder the eerie coincidence. Atkinson then persuades Withencroft to stay put until midnight in order to ensure that no accident befalls him on the journey home. Bad idea, but Withencroft agrees. Here's the final paragraph of August Heat. "The air seems charged with thunder. I am writing this at a shaky table before the open window. The leg is cracked, and Atkinson, who seems a handy man with his tools, is going to mend it as soon as he has finished putting an edge on his chisel. It is after 11 now. I shall be gone in less than an hour. But the heat is stifling. It is enough to send a man mad." An air conditioner would have made all the difference.
You can find the story August Heat in the AIR reprint edition of W.F. Harvey's first short story collection, Midnight House. Our engineers this week are Bob Alls, Thad Kirk, and Audrey Vablaitis. Steve Motter is our research assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, fast-pitch softball pitcher Kathy Aronson. For 15 years, she's played with the amateur all-women softball team, the Raybestos Braquettes. They've just won their third national championship in a row. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and I hope you can join us for the next Fresh Air.